full of cowrie shells. I got a pocket full of cowrie shells. I got a pocket full of cowrie. Bless you for the extra, may the messages travel well. I got a pocket full of cowrie shells. I got a pocket full of cowrie shells. I got a pocket full of cowrie. Bless you, extra. May the messages hit those. Stay composed, true. A pocket full of cowrie. Remember what the Babylon said to do. My signature old new. And you work so well. I prevail in situations I wasn't supposed to. The messages travel well. I'm just learning now. Accept the power behind the veil. I study water at times. I know it well. Ancestors came. Hear my daughter breath. Been close to death. Florida water accentuates my steps. Touch ground, shake, right on in, pocket full of cowrie shells. I'm blessed in an instant, it all makes sense. Putting shrines on the top of black new world. The mighty man, which original, extend the well, welcome to the crowd. It's been a while. Bless you for the hands, you make the messages travel well.
You're listening to Wolf Hawk Jagger, Cowrie Shells, and this is a special edition of Wanda's Picks. We are celebrating San Francisco independent art and culture and the SF Indie Fringe Festival. And we are joined in the studio by the playwright Bennett Fisher, and I'm not certain if they're together, and the director of Jessica Prudencio. Are you all together?
We're here.
Yes.
Oh, okay, excellent, excellent. And we're going to talk about Campo Maldito, and before I introduce them, I just want to just give you some of my impressions from last Saturday when I saw the play in San Francisco at the Exit Theater, where all of SF Fringe plays are being presented through September 20th. Campo Maldito by Bennett Fisher, directed by Jessica Prudencio, is an original take on gentrification. Heard the saying, if the walls could speak? Well, in Campo Maldito, the walls not only speak, they breathe, demand retribution, and scare the daylights out of Ken Ingersoll, portrayed by actor Walker Hare. A young upstart white boy who has nothing but disdain for the former inhabitants of the flat he occupies. Unable to sleep unless inebriated, he hears voices and senses a living presence in the room with him in his sober moments. Close to losing it completely, his friend recommends a santero, or priest in African diaspora traditional religion, to help him resolve the matter, or at least investigate it. Acosta, portrayed by actor Luis Vega, the priest, confirms his client's suspicions, and $1,000 is exchanged, cementing the deal. The priest sets up his altar and says a prayer in the West African language, Yoruba, the language of ceremony, before starting. The authenticity worried me. I didn't want any aroused spirits to walk from the room with us. The Exit Theater is right in the mix, that is, in the center of the locale in dispute on stage. As the two men wrestled with the ghost, former girlfriend of Acosta, the priest, I thought about the notion of displacement and where spirit goes when separated from its body. It has nothing left except the memory of displacement. I can see how such a legacy could make one mad and angry, she is. Abandoned by the man she cared about, who happens to be the priest, Acosta, we are not certain if Acosta will live through the ceremony, let alone the yuppie who wants to retire at 40. Acosta talks about the last day the two saw each other. He fills in the space, the abyss she and so many occupy. He says he went to a store for more alcohol and never returned. It was what he saw there on the street that helped him regain his sobriety and realize that he was no good to himself or his community drunk. The encounter in the apartment the two Egun, or ancestor, girlfriend, and former boyfriend, now priest, share is closure for Acosta as well. When a community is emptied of its tenants, where does the energy go? Does it paint the walls and line the stairs, stain ceilings like spitballs? As the two men wrestle, Acosta and Ingersoll, one scared yet embarrassed, that it has come to this, his life in the hands of a person he once would have stepped over in the street like debris. Even so, Ingersoll, with his livelihood and eventually life held in a balance, cannot control the bigoted remarks raining from his mouth, apologies mixed in with every other word. Ken Ingersoll does not believe in what he cannot see, and so he makes Acosta's job harder. Acosta doesn't wear robes and African attire. He wears a jersey around his waist, a fanny pack that is full of special ingredients for the spiritual cleansing. The exorcism is a jaunt that had me sitting on the edge of my seat. The story doesn't really end. It just flips to the next page with a commodification of property and people and the value inherent in the hands of those who hold the deck. What lies ahead for those who have money to displace entire peoples with a handshake or a paper document? The evening I attended Campo Maldito, the streets were full of homeless people in and about Eddy Street, Taylor and Ellis and Stockton. It was 9 and then 10 p.m., and there were people barely holding onto their sanity walking along the same sidewalks as modern voyeurs or theater patrons. Spirit is real, even unseen, even when ignored or dismissed. Campo Maldito has 3 more performances at San Francisco Fringe, and we're going to talk about that. But the performances are September 12th at 6, September 18th at 10:30, and September 16th at 7, actually 4, and September 20th at 2:30. And everything is at the Exit Theater, 156 Eddy Street. Welcome.
Thank you.
That was beautiful. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I just like wrote that when I got home because it was like, ah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, Bennett, you're a company member of Campo Santo. We know Campo Santo.
That's right.
That's Intersection for the Arts,
yeah.
Resident Theater. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you're associate artist with Cutting Ball Theater, right around the corner from the exit.
Right around the corner, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of those companies have really shaped me as a playwright. And this play is actually dedicated to Sean San Jose of Campo Santo.
Nice.
But you know, and of course the title is kind of a little shout out of sorts, I guess, with Campo in it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I think both these companies are, very engaged in the communities in which they're a part. At Cutting Ball, we did a wonderful docudrama piece called Tenderloin, which is all about the neighborhood, interviewing mm-hmm. residents and people who work and live in the area, and I think showing a different side than many San Franciscans see. I love the Tenderloin, but it's also a place, and I've been guilty of this too, where you get out of your car and you just try to get through the different blocks without really taking it in or without truly looking at the people who are there and the beauty that is there. I think the play is a gesture to try to a plea for people to notice one another in the city mm-hmm. and to not vilify the other side, but as the city gentrifies and changes, it's very easy to think of it as adversarial and not to think about how we're stewards of our neighborhood, whether you're a tech billionaire or someone down and out in Central Market. So it's been really magical to take the play here and to do it in the city for which it's written and to which it's dedicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're a San Franciscan. You were born and raised there in San Francisco.
Yeah, born and raised. I lived in Western Addition for the last 6 years before starting grad school. I think it's just, I don't think I really appreciated how much San Francisco was a part of who I am until someone took me away. And then I'm in San Diego at UCSD with a bunch of other wonderful artists. But I don't know, in some ways I could see myself for the first time as someone who's really shaped by the Bay. My family, my dad works in the tech industry as an engineer. I grew up mm-hmm. with a lot of people like Ken Ingersoll, who all want to be tech billionaires, and many of whom are very, lovely and compassionate people, but who are at odds with the city that they live in and part of that change on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this play is kind of an effort to bridge the gap between the people I know on either side of the divide, who I think are the two characters in the play, they're more similar than they would each acknowledge. I think that's the realization we come to at the end, that
mm-hmm.
they're both desperate people in need of help. And once they recognize that in each other, even a little bit, their lives can move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you pronounce Santeros. How do you pronounce his first name? I just couldn't figure
it
out.
Oh, Geronimo.
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 Okay.
It's like a really obscure. I wanted a name that was Spanish, but it was a little unusual. And Geronimo is also a name of a character in a play called Spanish Tragedy by Thomas Kidd, which is one of my favorite plays. So, mm-hmm. yeah, there are all kinds of little Easter eggs in Compomadre. It was great doing it in the Bay. And, you know, when you say 21 Club or when you talk about the mural on Polk Street, people actually mm-hmm. know, you know, they've been there. They've walked past it on their way to the theater maybe, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Ken's last name, Ingersoll, you know, you could play on that, anger, and then soul, like soul. Were you thinking of all that when you created that name?
You know, actually, Ingersoll is named after a dear friend of mine, Tori Ingersoll Thorpe, who's about as different from the character in the play as you could possibly think. So he's a wonderful director. He used to run a theater called Sleepwalkers. And he's now, he still directs around the Bay, but he and I work together a lot. And, I mean, like I said, I think I filled the play with a lot of just little love notes to San Francisco, the people I knew here, the places that I've lived. So, yeah, you know, I think as a writer, a lot of it, you know, it comes from the subconscious. You don't really think about it as you're making it, but then when you step back, you're like, oh, well, I've... You know, this name or that name, it's just whatever's in the blood when you're sitting mm-hmm. down to write.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you've done a whole lot of writing and directing in the Bay Area, and people can visit your website, BennettFisher.net, and read about to get all the details.
Indeed.
but, you know, like you started quite a few theaters, and you're a part of some theaters, and it's so cool, the intersection between, the creativity and the business of theater. You know, it's like, okay, well, I can write this, but if there's no theater, where am I going to, present it? So you have these wonderful theaters that I had never even heard of, like People of Interest, that Jessica, that you are artistic director of. And then the Mbutu Theater Project, which both of you are a part of.
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
really interesting. Jessica, you're a director, choreographer, community-based artist. You've worked on many plays, musicals, dance mm-hmm. theater works. You're also a member of the Ping Chong Plus Company, and you worked as a writer, mm-hmm. director, and facilitator of a dozen interdisciplinary and documentary theater projects, including mm-hmm. co-writing and directing Listen to Me, Voices of Survivors of Child Sexual Abuse and Those Who Helped Them. And that was presented mm-hmm. in Bronx and Manhattan. And you are from the New York Tisch School of the Arts with a mm-hmm. BA, and you have a graduate degree from New York University's Graduate Musical Theater Writing Project Program.
I work with artists there. Currently also in graduate school with Ben at UC San Diego. But I did a project.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. You all are connected in so many ways, aren't you?
Yeah, well, that's sort of how the play came about. At the end of the year, the writers each produce a new play directed by the MFA directors with the cast of MFA actors. So all the whole team for Campo Maldito, we did an earlier version of the play. I mean, the play has been revised a lot, but with the same, with Jessica directing, with the same two actors, Walker and Louise, many of the same designers and technical team. Mm-hmm. So it's been great. I mean, it was such a joy working on that play down there with them, but we've since with People of Interest and now with Ubuntu Theater Project, we've taken it to New York and San Francisco, and to be able to bring something we've worked on in school for a very small audience, you know, of the people who are there and maybe anyone who from the area comes to see it, and mm-hmm. to take it to to New York and to the Bay has been really transformative.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think also this may be a new play that we did in school, and we're all, artists. I think what's so great about this show and what drew me to this play was that it was about the people for the people, which is a big part, which is why I wanted to start my theater company, because I wanted to do work that was, you know, about real people. And so it's been, I've really felt that. I mean, the New York crowd, they loved it. I mean, we got such great reviews there, and we sold out our houses. It was amazing, and people didn't know the references.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something about the show that New York audiences and San Diego audiences really connected to and thought that they could see part of themselves in that, and bringing it home for Ben. It was, you know, we went to New York, my home, and now bringing it home for Ben.
Yeah.
It's just so clear that this is very much a community-based project in a way.
I think so, and I think it's also, you know, it's in the way that we've worked together. Like, I mean, I'm so happy I've got to spend the year with Jessica in the summer as well, because I think she's now a huge, you know, her fingerprints are all over this piece, not just in the directing, but also in the writing and in the story. Mm-hmm. And it's been a very open process. The actors will suggest things about the script. We'll all kind of talk and figure it out. And so it's great when a piece, you know, stops being your play and becomes our play. And I think that that's, you know, that's the type of collaborative environment I learned at Cutting Ball and Campo Santo, where it's really about the people and who you're making it with and who you're making it for. So it's nice to be able to replicate that again. I have a very hard time imagining this play without Jessica at the helm and without these two actors, because it seems so so personalized to all of us at this point, which is, it doesn't always happen, sadly, but it's really special when it does.
Yeah, that's really excellent. I was just thinking, Jessica, how physical the theater is, the piece is, and, you know, with your work in choreography, I'm sure that really helped you envision how it could look on stage, you know, given the actors, you know, being in good shape as well. getting hit in the
well,
head with...
Well, I don't know at this point.
Probably a little digged up.
I have a habit of ripping pants during my rehearsals. I think that's part of that, since a lot of my training also working with Ping Chong Company, who is an interdisciplinary artist, is that every part of, including the text and the design, everybody has an equal part in telling the story. And so I also felt like I want to understand the play even when I close my ears and I'm just watching. And so I really take into account the visual, every part of the visual aspects of the show. I do feel that. It's funny now talking to people who know me, who know my work, who have seen the play, and they really see how I've grown in the last year, because they can really hear the text, they can really experience a story, but they see it as very physical, which is something that happens in most of my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I was sitting in the theater with someone who had been to quite a few plays SF Fringe season, she was saying, well, where's the set? From the pictures, there's supposed to be a set. And then here you all come in 5 minutes. You have taped, you know, the room, you know, sort of like the boundaries. You know, you put in the furniture. It's like, that was fast.
I mean, it's a little crazy, you know. It's definitely total guerrilla theater. Jessica and I mean, there's the artistic side of it, too, but I feel like so much of our summer has just been figuring out, you know, how do we get the chairs where they need to be. How do we, like, we have to buy a beanbag, and it's got to be flameproof, and we can't ship it across country, so we got to buy a new one. And I think, you know, it's that stuff, but that really makes it important, because you work so hard just to get it to the theater, to get it up and to do it, that by the time the play starts, you've invested so much of yourself in it. And I think it's been... It's been a total labor of love, but really, I love at the center of that chaos and actually, like, you know, to feel like you're building it as it's happening. It's great. But yeah, mm-hmm. It would be nice to be able to leave the set in the theater overnight, you know, one day.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk about Bennett and Jessica. If you could talk about, you know, the ritual in the work, in the ceremony, and because I spoke to Louise afterwards, so I'm like, what language were you speaking? He said, yeah. I was like, oh, okay. So this is real. So anyway, yeah, I was wondering, sort of talk about the ritual and sort of calling the Egun, like, in the prayer.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. How did you do
well,
that?
I think,
I mean, like,
you know,
sort of authenticity around
that. I think it was important.
That.
It was important for me, I think, as I said earlier, to be, you know, I think when gentrification gets talked about, it's often talked about in a very simplistic or reductive way. So I wanted the play to capture all the, you know, or as much complexity as I could. And with the Santeria elements, you know, a lot of people, I think, are afraid of Santeria or sensationalize it, you know,
mm-hmm.
like witch doctors and voodoo stuff. And I think, number one, that's a little offensive, or actually a lot offensive. Because so much of what Santeria is about healing and honoring your ancestors and, you know, feeling connected to those who have passed in order to better the future. And I did a lot of research into it with an effort to make it as authentic as possible. And I think also a lot of work went into the creation of Luis's character to make him, you know, that he's not some sort of magical being. He's just a guy in a Niners jersey who knows how to do these ceremonies and who's connected to that. So all of the rituals that happen in the play, they're all, I think, as authentic as I know how to make them. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
there are elements that are a little, you know, kind of sensationalized for the drama. But, yeah, I think it's – you can tell in the audience when you're watching something that's real and when you're watching something that's not. And
mm-hmm.
I think that there, the more I got into Santeria, the more I was just sort of enchanted by, the beauty and the purity of what the belief is about. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was actually funny that I was there when you asked him about the languages, because it turns out my husband is actually Yoruba. So when Ben first added the language, I said, this looks and sounds so familiar. And then I sat with my mother-in-law, and we went through it, and she said, it's of a different time. And but she and I were able to kind of go through it phonetically. So
I got really lucky. I mean, I think, you know, Jessica also, you know, she we've talked a lot together. Jessica found this great YouTube channel of a young Santero talking mm-hmm. about his work and about the ceremonies that, you know, I don't know, was just great, because so much of I mean, there's not a lot of books on Santeria that are really that reliable. And to actually be able to listen to this young man on YouTube talk about the work that he does and what it means to him and walk everyone through the ceremonies, I don't think the play would have been the same without Jessica, like, opening those doors and doing those research and things like that and having it affect the writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I really love the way you let spirit of the people that were displaced but was still there, like they didn't have anywhere to go, you let them speak. I thought that was just so wonderful. And that sort of goes in line, you know, Jessica, with the whole idea of people of interest. You say that the theater gives voice to the voiceless and reveals the hidden truths through new original work, and this is definitely original work and new.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one big, I guess my concept in a way for this was, how can we also make addiction just as scary or even scarier than the spirit?
Mm-hmm.
And so to feel people, to talk to people after the show and how terrified they were and the suspense of it all, that was really the goal. Because I think it's really hard to get scared in theater.
Yeah.
I think in movies, I get scared a lot.
That's a good point.
But in theater, it's really hard. Without, like, the spooky haunted house theater thing, we don't want any creaking doors in the show.
Yeah.
But I think that comes with the spirit. How I think the spirit is where we brought the fear.
There's actually been the difference of doing it in the Tenderloin. And I was watching it on Saturday, and you know, I've seen the play now a dozen times. This, you know, after I was like, oh, my God, this is, like, really freaky. Like, Jessica's, like, created something that's totally terrifying. But it's because you're right there in the neighborhood. And I think both the fear and the love in the play seem stronger in the Tenderloin. And that is maybe a spiritual thing, you know. like actually feeling that you're really, you know, that what's happening on stage is really reflecting the world outside. I mean, it's always a hard thing to know whether you're doing it as an artist, but I think it's important to me and to Jessica and the actors to, you know, to do something that...
Oh, darn. I lost them. Well, hopefully they'll call back in a minute. Yeah, this is a really wonderful piece. I'm going to play a little music while they rejoin us. I'm going to play, again, another one from Wolf Hawk Jaggard, As You Exit, while we wait for them to join us again. I told my audience that you were going to call us back. I was playing another work from Wolf Hall Jagger. It's called As You Exit. So what were we talking about? I didn't have a note. Do you remember where you were when
the Yoruba stuff and the Santeri elements in the play.
Yes.
I was talking about a little bit about how unusual it is to be afraid in theater, and the way that the addiction stuff is scarier than the...
Right, yes. Yeah, Jessica, why don't you continue talking about that? Because thanks for bringing that up, because that's a real theme in the work, sobriety and not being, you know, addicted, and how addiction, was a large part of the relationship that... Lee Santero had with his girlfriend. I mean, they were high a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that gentrification is definitely a big part of it and the setting of it. But yeah, I think the addiction really is what links them to the two characters. Actually,
yes.
It links all three characters.
Yeah.
In a way, I mean, that's something we say: it's three characters to two actors. And I think that's something that I started to really bring in our, when we were first staging it in the second part of our rehearsal process. I started to really remember that is also the reason, one of the big reasons why Acosta left the Tenderloin. And because of how this ghost has this, you know, his former girlfriend, how she has this power over him. That's one of her weapons, actually, against Acosta, because that's a weakness. That's his biggest weakness, and that's obvious, ultimately what she uses against him. So I started to really remember that and make sure that was super clear in the show, because there's so many things that it's about but I feel like that is a very, it's something that a lot of people can relate to, and it's what ultimately, I think it's the strongest weapon in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some way, you know, I spoke to a lot of people who are in recovery writing the piece. And one thing that I heard from a close friend of mine is that, you know, you spend so much time and energy just getting sober, but then it's like, now what? You know, like, what do I do with my life mm-hmm. now that I've achieved this thing? It's how it's not a destination you arrive at, but something that is a continual part of your energy. And I was just so I think that that's just a lovely metaphor for, you know, how we deal with a lot of things in our lives. You spend so much effort trying to get somewhere. We don't really think about where we are when we're there, whether it's a relationship, whether it's addictive personality, whether it's this dream of making a company, or the way that we're developing our cities, you know. We want to put on all these new buildings and all these fancy places, but I don't think anybody's really thought about what happens when they're there and when the people who used to be there are gone and what that changes. It's been very hard for me to come back to San Francisco and to see how much is different even in the year of being away and to feel like a lot of things that I've loved about the city are on their way out and that something else is coming in its place that I'm not sure I'm so crazy about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking about the Sontero, you know, Costa, and even Ingersoll. They're both young men, and for both of them, they're on journeys, and there's some healing that needs to take place for both of them. I mean, there are these loose ends, and the alcohol is a way to self-medicate. Certainly. With, you know, Ingersoll, I mean, he can't sleep without being completely drunk.
Yeah,
he's just like, he puts alcohol in everything, coffee. He's like, no.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you all have, like, those bottles, you know, the bottles, you think about the symbolism around the bottles as spirit catchers. You know, you think about in the cemeteries in the South. I'm from New Orleans, and in Mississippi and Alabama, they have these bottles. A lot of times, they have color, and those are for the spirits. And then sometimes you put water in them, like in different levels of water, and that's the place, you know, sort of it protects, but it also is a place to hold the spirit. So I thought it was kind of interesting. And then you think about alcohol. Alcohol is called spirit, right?
Wanda, you're like drawing things out of this show that I was not aware of at all writing it. I this is wonderful.
Oh, this is a wonderful, wonderful work.
Something you said, though, about the healing, I mean, for me, and I think actually for everyone involved, it's a very important aspect of why we're doing the work that we're doing. And I don't really believe in the torture artist. I believe in the playful artist. And mm-hmm. what's been so gratifying about this process and about the audience is that it was a lot about the play that's very dark, but I think there's also a lot about it that, you know, the humor that Jessica and the actors bring to it is wonderful. The sense of play and suspense, we laugh a lot in the room, rehearsing it, putting it on its feet, and the audience has been very lively. And it's nice to feel like that people walk out of the piece, you know, uplifted and not despondent about gentrification or the changing city or addiction or whatever it is. And I think that's been a real special part about taking it to New York and taking it to San Francisco is seeing how it affects people and how it is, you know, maybe if not healing something, at least like comforting or mm-hmm. or uplifting.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very important to me.
Yeah. Perhaps we could talk about, you know, the collaborating theaters, you know, with SF Fringe. You know, we've got...
Yeah,
can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think Christina and Richard of the SF Fringe and Amanda, our technical director, I mean, I'm mm-hmm. so inspired by the stuff that they're doing or that they have been doing for forever. It's a real, you know, it's a true fringe. It's total democracy. It's theater by the people, for the people, and they've been amazingly supportive just all throughout all stages of the process. I started the very first play I did was in the SF Fringe, so it's really come back to this, six, 7 years later. And I don't know, just feel that the exit is really, I think, at the center of the San Francisco theater community. Almost 1,000 theater companies have crossed through their doors in the time that they've been there. And many of these companies are, you know, places that are enduring institutions today. Cutting Ball, Crowded Fire, both started at the Fringe. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to be a part of that legacy, to be with them.
Yeah, I to go even further back, I mean, Ben and I did the play at the UC San Diego Wagner Theater Festival, and it did so, and we just got such a great response from it. You know, Ben and I looked at each other and said, you know, I said, I want to bring it home to New York, and he said, I want to bring it home to San Francisco, and I said, that's our summer, baby.
Yeah.
That's our summer. So I had a history with the New York Fringe, having directed and designed there, and Ben had this strong history with San Francisco Fringe. I was thinking of starting my own company, and I thought this was a perfect first project for it. So that's how we started. We applied and got in, and we started to plan our summer of this tour, which has been great because, you know, so much, especially as a younger theater artist, you do one show and, you know, you get it up and that's it. And I think that was also a goal for myself as an artist, is that I want to do a show and I want to do it good and I want to do it, for more than one weekend.
Yeah.
Like, why not?
Yeah.
And we're really being rewarded for it in a way. You know, we're seeing, where you see the work, you see the history on stage. And it's given us time to really develop relationships and audiences.
The other group that we wanted to sort of shout out to has helped us produce the SF run is Ubuntu Theater Project, which is a relatively new company. I guess this is now their second season in Oakland, started by UC San Diego MFA students. Michael Moran, who's a director who's entering his third and final year there, is from El Cerrito. And he has this dream of, you know, building a theater in Oakland for the people, by the people. And this is one of six plays happening this summer in their Breaking Chains Festival. Many, many UCSD actors and designers, directors, choreographers are up here working on the plays, but also people from the community in Oakland. Dance of the Holy Ghost by Marcus Garley is running now. Near the MacArthur Bar at Envision Academy, and it's a combination of UCSD people and this amazing choir from Oakland. It's a really wonderful performance that I hope people check out. I think it's running like through this week, and then there are three more plays that are opening in the next week, but online at ubuntutheaterproject.com. Ubuntu is U-B-U-N-T-U, all U's. You can find out information not just about Campo Maldito and the other performances there at the SF Fringe with people of interest and Ubuntu, but the whole rest of the Ubuntu Festival. And I think that, you know, all the things we've been talking about community, about theater for, a changing city, about work that heals and uplifts, Ubuntu really embodies that in the work that they're doing as well. So I hope that those people who come to Campo Maldito will go and see those other shows and vice versa. You know, you get six plays and they're all pay what you want at the tour. Pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is pretty amazing. Could you tell our audience sort of what Ubuntu means? It's a South African concept.
It's the Zulu proverb that I guess translates roughly into I am because we are. I think that the company embodies a lot of that identity through community, that you're not who you are as an individual. You are who you are by those around you and the people who have shaped you, which I think is something that, you know, everyone who's involved in the project really embodies. And I think that's something that's, you know, been very clear to me, making this play with people that I really love and care about, taking it to these cities that we we have such a history with, and seeing the response it's gotten, you know, that's the most relevant work always comes out of that kind of shared desire and identity. I think that, you know, if theater can't be a place to have, to build a community, it's not doing a lot of good. I feel like that a lot of just the philosophy of the company, making the plays cheap and available, doing them all over Oakland, involving the community, engaging students from Laney College with Michael Torres, and having them be a really active part in the work we're building. You know, it's all a desire to bring good art to everyone, not just the people who can afford, you know, a $100 ticket to something. It feels great to be a part of that.
Yeah, and Michael Torres, he's also one of the founders of Campo Santo, and he's one of my colleagues.
Yeah, I know. It's sort of
I teach at the College of Alameda.
And also Michael Torres is a UCSD alumni from, I don't know what year.
Really?
But yeah, there's a lot of, like, I mean, these kind of strange UCSD, Campo Santo, people of interest, Ubuntu web that's created. I think the work that he's doing in Oakland with his students from Laney College is so exciting to see a young generation. I guess they're not really that much younger than me, so I can't really call them a different generation. But of young people who are passionate and who really want to make work for the place they live. You know, no one's aspiring to kind of get out of Oakland and you know, go do things on Broadway. They want to bring it here, and they want to contribute to the incredible legacy of the Bay through the work, which is very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole idea of Ubuntu, I am, because you are, because we are, I should say. That's sort of that value comes. That's sort of what we see in the conclusion of the play. The Santero, you know, he goes in there, Acosta goes on there, you know, it's a job, you know, he can make some money, and not necessarily, you know, I can help bring some peace to this man who's suffering, you know, from the being haunted, but it's like, you know, $1,000, like, it might be a fast job, who knows, and I'm not guaranteeing anything, so, you know, it might not work, but I still get my money. And then what happens is it's a whole, you know, ceremony that happens between the interaction between these two men and the spirit, you know, that they are trying to bring a resolution to as well, because she's haunted. And that's why she is so angry. So the whole idea is like, okay, how can we come to some kind of agreement so that everyone, you know, is able to walk from here, or I don't know what spirits do, but, have some resolution. And the Egon, you know, she has the first and last and final say, because she's got more power. Even though Acosta has a whole lot of stuff in his waste pack, you know, medicine bag. That's really great, the way he's like sprinkling water and shaking up stuff in the bottle, and you know,
more and more stuff is coming out. I think something you said really, I love that. You know, when you the play does, and we talk a lot about bringing people together, but I think, you know, the way that Jessica's directed the end, the characters don't necessarily like each other at the end of the play, but they learn to acknowledge one another, and they learn that their fates are intertwined and their lives are intertwined. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, as I see the way that New York is changing, the way that San Francisco is changing, the way that many cities are changing, you know, we don't necessarily have to like the people that we're, that are coming into the city and changing things. We don't necessarily need to like the way that the direction of the cities are going, but I feel like we have to start acknowledging that we're all together in this, and that if we're going to function as a society, that, you know, we can't operate as if the other element is going to go away, no matter what side of the gentrification divide you're on. And I think that's something that, you know, is playing out sometimes in a very violent way in our country. And until I think, you know, real ownership is taken on both sides, it's going to be hard to resolve that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's about mutual respect, because that's the way it seems at the
yeah.
end, that, you know, all of a sudden Ingersoll is not apologizing. He actually sees Acosta, and he even realizes that this man saved my life, even though, you know, he wasn't quite following what was going on, you know, in the spiritual mm-hmm. realm. He, you know, whenever he would come back to himself, and I love the way he, you know, the actor Walker Hare could be embodied, like, oh, he is so good. Like, this is what
yeah.
I see, like, when I see the movies about people being, you know, the ego and taking them over, you know, and using their body as a vehicle. That was so cool. Why don't we talk about the actors, because they were fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah, they were such a pleasure to work with. They work their butts off. They've you know, they are students, but they've been around. I mean, they both lived in New York for a long period of time, acting and doing mostly theater, but also a lot of film, which I think also helped for this work, that you do feel the film quality, because the film acting and theater acting are so different. But I think them having a strong film experience has definitely helped them in this process for this work, and creating the intimacy on stage. That was so important to me, that how can, it's a theater and we need to, you know, see things and hear things, but how can we make the audience feel like they're right in the room with us?
I think they're both just really playful guys. You know, Walker and Louise, they like to, they like the kind of spontaneous things that happen in live performance. They play off each other very well. And I feel like they're, you know, watching Jessica working with them in the room was wonderful, because she'd sort of throw new ideas, new choreography at them, and they'd pick it up and play with it. And I think there was a real desire to keep digging and to keep pushing, even after it was on its feet. You know, how can we go deeper? How can we do more? How can we make this even more layered and complex?
It's
wonderful.
I want to talk a little bit about Walker's transformation. We played around with so many different ideas right at the beginning, because we, you know, even when Ben and I talked about her, we didn't quite know who she was. I had an idea, he had an idea, the actors had an idea, but of who she could be and what she sounded like, or even images or some women from our own lives that we know that are like her. The more we rehearsed it, the more minimal we went, that she didn't have this, you know, big walk or big kind of had these pictures that wanted to be more part of him in a way. And that's why he doesn't like change his voice to be really high or start to strut like a woman. It feels more organic, which is, I think, scarier.
I think Jessica deserves a lot of credit for that. You know, at no point she was like, we're not going to go say with it, you're not going to be, you know, you don't want it to feel like bad drag where you're performing femininity. Like, this has to be a person first, and it's someone who happens to be a woman, but that's not the identity. And yeah, I think that, you know, it is terrifying to watch it, because you see he doesn't seem quite like a man or quite like a woman, but this strange thing in between, it's very dangerous and very grounded and physically imposing. I, watching Walker every night, just, it seems like he grows another foot when he becomes Amelia. And that's great, you know, to have, and I think that's all Jessica's work with the body and with choreography, you know, thinking about how these guys just inhabit space and how much is communicated through their physicality. Louise as well, I think, you know, as the play goes on, I think that you can see the exhaustion on his character getting more and more. He comes in with a great deal of confidence and with this kind of swagger, and then by the end, he's just, you know, reduced. And it's in the way that he holds his shoulders and, you know, wipes sweat from his brow. Like, I think it's so much, as a writer, you think about language a lot, but I think so much more storytelling is done through the body and through movement. You know, it's very immediate. You can't lie. The body can't pretend to be something else. It's just there. Or you can maybe say something that's not true. So, yeah, I love how, yeah, as we get deeper and deeper into it, that most of the story seems to be told through through just how the actors are in the space and not necessarily what they're saying.
Yeah, and I think it's great that we created this show in a educational environment where all we have to do is focus on being, you know, good actors, directors,
yeah,
playwrights, that we weren't balancing anything else but doing this show. I mean, we're balancing a lot of classes. But that's our focus. And even in our time in New York and in our time here, this is our full focus, is just, you know, doing this show. So we've definitely been blessed with the time and focus to really make it, give it what it deserves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think the two actors have also, you know, they've really left their mark on the play in the writing and, you know, kind of the tone of the piece. Since I've been revising it with them in the room with Jessica at the helm this whole time, you know, I think it's molded to who they are as individuals in an interesting way. And I'd be very curious to see what this play feels like with different people, because I can't really imagine anybody else right now. You know, I mean, I'm hoping that at some point I'll you know, it'll reach a larger audience and there'll be revivals and other things with different casts. But yeah, I think that everyone really, you know, actors, directors, designers have, there's a very shared identity with this piece, which is great.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how, you know, from the beginning, when, you know, the curtain rises and we enter the scene and we don't quite know what's going on, and immediately someone is assaulted. and so, you know, and it goes like that. I mean, there's like a whole lot of brutality in this work.
Yeah,
but then you know, it's a hard life. I mean, you know, particularly when you're, you know, the kind of place you have us in, you know, with Campo Maldito. You know, we've got to disrupt a whole world order. and that's painful. And people are going to get injured. And people are going to get hurt. And not many people are going to walk away without Band-Aids and limps and, you know, missing different parts of themselves. But hopefully, you know, within this process, you know, people can grow. But it's just really unfortunate that it has to happen like that. You know, does it have to be like this? You know, does it have to be as brutal? You know, can't, you know, sort of like work it out beforehand so that nobody gets, you know, loses their lives or falls into, you know, these places where you can't find them anymore?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I hope so. I don't know. I think that it's sort of the job of the artist or the writer to, you know, you want to be trafficking in things that are extreme, matters of life and death, you know, huge people at really, really dire straits. And maybe that's not necessarily being homeless or addicted, but to something, but, you know, just desperate. And there's a level of desperation in the play that makes, you know, keeps the audience engaged. So I do think there is a way to you know, as a society, to find all that, you know, sense of community, to heal collectively without going all the way down into the mud and then coming back. But, you know, I think it's theater's job to show the fringe and the margin of people who are hanging on by their fingernails in one way or another. You know, the stakes are really high in this piece. It's life and death from the first scene on. It's funny, the audience, I feel like, is still kind of getting its bearings, and then once he gets hit in the face, like, suddenly people are locked in. Like, oh, okay, like, we're not going to be sitting and talking for an hour. Like,
yeah.
For better or worse, you know, it depends on the sort of play you want to see.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, you know, that Acosta is praying to Oya, you know, and Oya, you know, she's, you know, the Orisha that sort of stirs stuff up, and she's the tempest,
definitely.
She's the wind, she just blows everything all over the place, you know, she's the hurricane, the wind behind the water, so, great energy to evoke, you know, to sort of you know, sometimes you have to level everything and build it over again, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I love chaos and energy on stage. I feel like it's always really exciting to watch. And, you know, so much of our lives are routine that when I go to the theater, I want to be surprised. I want to be scared. I want to be sort of shaken
mm-hmm.
out of wherever I am. But I think there's a way to set that in a playful way, in a fun way, and not in a, you know, emotionally manipulative or a way that makes people feel despair or downtrodden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you certainly have the attention, both of you, of anyone that sits down in the theater to see Campo Maldito. It's like, okay. Yeah, I mean, everybody's walking like, "Whoa, that was so good! Oh my gosh!" Yeah, it is awesome.
Scary.
Oh my goodness! Yeah,
yeah.
If I can get back through, I'm gonna try to get back through.
I can't imagine doing it.
Yeah, it's really wonderful.
Thank you, Robert.
I want to. Oh, you're welcome. Any closing thoughts? I want to let our audience know again that, you know, we're speaking to Bennett Fisher and Jessica Prudencio about Campo Maldito, currently one of the plays in the San Francisco Fringe, and there are four more chances to see this great play.
I think three more, actually. We've got.
Is it three more?
Did I
have extra?
Yeah. I think you gave us an extra performance maybe earlier.
Okay, so what three are they?
I wish there were four more. I wish there were ten more. Closing thoughts.
So is it 9:12 at 6, 9:18 at 10:30, and 9:20 at 2:30?
I think it's 9:12 this Friday at 10:30, and then 9:18 Tuesday at 7, and then 9:20, which is a Saturday at 2:30.
Okay. All right. Yeah, people should go to SF Fringe just to check. You don't want to get there late because they will not let you in.
Yeah.
At all. And you should get there, you know, like maybe 10 minutes early because particularly if you reserve seats, because they sell your tickets if you don't get there early.
Yeah,
and you don't want to miss this. This is a really fabulous work. Yeah,
thank
it's
you.
Really, really great. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I mean, I think my closing thought would be just there's. I hope people make it out to this play, but the other play is in the Ubuntu Festival, Breaking Chains. The other plays in the San Francisco Fringe. There's a lot of great work happening,
mm-hmm.
and I think the more you see, you know, the richer you are for it. So I hope people come out to this, but also take advantage of all that's happening this summer in the Bay
mm-hmm.
with Ubuntu and with the Fringe. It's wonderful things all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Jessica?
I think that this whole experience, especially finally feeling like this is our real opening here in San Francisco, has been so rich. And I feel completely immersed in my work as an artist right now, living, breathing, and directing a show about the Tenderloin, about the people here. We've had such great, incredible excitement around the show. I know there will be a life for it beyond this, the next three performances.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just very thankful for all the excitement and the love that San Francisco has given us for Campo Maldito.
Very well said.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the
thank
show.
You.
Congratulations, and look forward to seeing you again in the theater.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Take care. Right, bye-bye. So we are going to close with a shoe exit on Play It All Out, and this is Wolf Hawk Jagger.
I go, Lona, I go, Lona. mie mi so ye mo ba je de o awon baba lore gun awon alagba lore gun mie mi so je mie mi so je mo ba je de o. Esu odara keyinyawo Esu siwaju ko mama keyin Odara keyinyawo siwaju ko mama ke Elegbara keyinyawo
Jaguar.